And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
With summer come the carnivals, and one of the biggest is raging in the U.S. Senate. Yes, it's energy bill time again, and it's a freak show of special interests. We look at that, and then we feature some of the best of the Wild Side News as we look to the mountains, the oceans, and into the heart of our relationship with that most amazing friend and companion to the human species, those canine companions. So get set for another great adventure into the wonder when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News, and now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Welcome to this early summer edition of the Wild Side News. I just finished looking at where my listeners are from around the globe, and the Wild Side News is being heard in some pretty exotic places. Now, some of the top locations are, of course, San Diego, where most of my friends are, but also Chicago, New York, San Jose, Los Angeles, and other major cities. I encourage all of you to reach out and tell someone in your city about the Wild Side News so this voice of the earth keeps growing and growing. And it's also fun to hear some of the places that people tune in from. So I want to give a special greeting to all my listeners in these places. If you hear your city, I'd love to hear from you. So here are some of the top international listening posts. Munich, London, Johannesburg, Paris, Copenhagen, Hamburg, Caracas, Venezuela, Winnipeg, Kuala Lumpur, Havana, Cuba, just to name a few. If you are one of these international listeners, I'd like you to send me an email from the contact page and give me some information on what it is that's on your mind in your country. Or just anytime, send an email to wildsidenews@cox.net. That's wildsidenews@cox.net. Today, we feature three powerful segments. Following the news, we revisit two amazing nature photographers. Now, they don't just take pretty pictures, no. They create a phenomenal source of interactive panoramic photographs. Definitely check out today's show page for the link to the Mountain Visions website. You'll be so glad you did. In segment two, as the oceans are making headlines as hurricane season begins, we take another look at the oceans as we talk to one of the world's most significant caretakers and champions of the oceans when we hear from Scripps Institution of Oceanography's director, Dr. Charles Kennell, as he gives his State of the Oceans report. And then we explore one of the most powerful stories, and one I am so happy to share. It's the very personal story of a man tragically transformed in a truck accident who, after years of struggle, found himself confined to a wheelchair. His life became painful in many ways. And then he met Hawk, one of those miraculous animal companions. Here is a story you will want to listen to and share with your friends. So we've got a wonderful show ahead, and it all kicks off following the news. Tuesday, debate began on another attempt in the Senate to pass a national energy bill. Such has resulted in failure in two previous attempts. But energy and the environment, that long-standing dancing mantra that goes back to the 60s, is finally gaining respectability, not only in both the House and the Senate, but also by both parties. So this week, New Mexico's two energy champions, Pete Domenici and Jeff Bingaman, held hands and talked of really addressing an energy bill this session. The debate, which is televised at length on C-SPAN, seems more like a high school pageant than a serious debate over our energy future. What is being discussed? Almost everything, from supporting more efficient and rapid exploration and exploitation of America's oil resources, particularly offshore and oil shale, to ethanol, coal gasification, energy conservation, and the regular assortment of exploitables. One option that seems amazingly absent is any real talk about solar and hydrogen. Oh, sure, there are some requests for further study and reductions in our oil dependence, oh, within perhaps 20 years, but hydrogen and fuel cells continue to hold about as much weight as the hydrogen that inspires the debate. On the other hand, the new heavyweight in the battle, both literally and figuratively, is the new pretty boy, nuclear energy. France is doing it, Japan is too, so we should too. And new sites are being proposed to pour billions of dollars into centralized power stations in Scottsboro, Alabama, Port Gibson, Mississippi, St. Francisville, Louisiana, Aiken, South Carolina, and then, of course, in two right-off northern states, Lusby, Maryland, and Oswego, New York. When hydrogen is mentioned, it's almost always associated with its being produced from natural gas. And coal gasification brings billions and billions of dollars of renewed investment, as the clean tech vision remains essentially still something to be studied. Dreams of an Apollo project for energy are mentioned, but again receive the cynical rebuff of the grand energy champions, who know energy because they have been tied to oil and gas and coal, the real energy players, for decades. One of the more entertaining arguments that keeps resurfacing is that a hydrogen future is worthy of further study, but not a serious contender, as it represents such a small portion of the overall energy component. So it feels as if we will be heading down that old nuclear oil highway as the grand vision of America's oil independence. The real losers in this battle are the members of the Senate who throw political puffballs advocating more investment in alternative energies. The term nuclear option, which gained so much significance in the last 2 weeks, seems to continue its star status as the nuclear option now appears to be America's best hope for energy independence. They're everywhere. They're everywhere. That may be the vision of most of America's national parks, as cell phone companies have been given a relatively open ticket, in the name of camper safety, of course, to erect cell phone towers to provide unbroken coverage in our national parks. Without much public comment or oversight, cell phone companies are clamoring to the national parks with plans to provide service in what, till then, had been dead zones. This just may be the sound of nature coming soon to a national park near you. China keeps making its way back into the news. It's being mentioned as the nation's leading problem in the future of oil prices, and there is ample reason to believe such. China currently has a rather low car per capita ratio of a mere 5 per 1,000 people, but that number is changing each month. Car sales in China, the world's third largest market, rose 22.4% in May from the same time a year ago. Ford Motor Company saw its sales increase by 50% in 1 year. But the Chinese auto market is growing in ways Ford may find troubling in the years ahead. With General Motors wheezing with the first signs of economic pneumonia, China's emerging auto manufacturing capabilities will eventually place another giant challenge on the American auto manufacturers. Then what? Keep tuning in to the Wild Side News to find out. And that's the news. Well, we now turn our attention to someone who takes color beyond the boundaries and brings it back to you in a most amazing form. I want to welcome Gary Grimm, one half of the visionary photographic team who make up Mountain Vision. Gary, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
First, Gary, tell us about you and Katie Flanagan, how you spend your time creating the wonders of Mountain Visions, your company.
Well, for the past several years, almost 10 years, we found a way to use a computer and take photographs that create a 360-degree circle where you can actually visit a location on Earth, a spot, where you can see everything in view from that spot. And we can also create with the computer on the Internet interactive hotspots, so you can actually visit these places and find out a lot more information about details about the issues or problems or special features, plants and animals, or the resources that are at that spot.
That's absolutely right. And by the way, listeners, please go to the Wildside News show page today, and there you'll see images that, when you click on them, can take you to the actual demonstrations of these online experiences. And an online experience, it truly is. I'm just going to say, I literally spent about an hour and a half yesterday in my busy day taking adventures all around the world. Now, I'm trying to figure out if you should describe this or I should describe it, because why don't you first of all talk about what it is that a person will experience when they visit your website, and why don't you give that website now so that people can go there?
Well, our company is mountainvisions.com, so www.mountainvisions.com leads you into a website that we developed that more or less portrays a lot of the things that we've been doing in the recent years with the Internet. And, for example, one part that we have developed is a map of the state of Idaho that has a lot of these, the new panoramas that we're using are full screen, and they're really nice looking on your computer screen, and you can pan around and look at all the, everything in that view. And we've taken, especially taken some photographs of three wilderness areas in Idaho: the Owyhee Canyon lands, the Boulder White Clouds, and the Clearwater roadless areas. And all of these places are pretty currently issues that are important. Decisions are being made about whether or not and how much land might be preserved and how these areas will be managed in the future.
Well, Gary, you and Katie Flanagan have spent most of your life traveling around. I'm going to try to give people an idea of what it is we're talking about in terms of the experience. Go to the website. Don't miss this. It is absolutely astonishing. If you ever need a little break in life, and you're stuck in an office or stuck in a home and you'd like to go out to the wild, this is as close as I can imagine as an Internet experience to go out there, because what Gary and Katie have done, as they say, you go to the site, you click on it, and as you move your cursor, it literally goes around in a circle 360 degrees. You can look up, you can look down at what is exactly right in front of your feet, and then as well you can zoom in and find details. And in some cases, when you download a special little feature called the Zoomify?
That's one of the technologies that lets you zoom way into detail on the panorama.
These ultra high density photographs, you can look off way into the distance and zoom in and literally be looking at flowers. I have some applications of this we're going to talk about that I think are just extraordinary. Why this matters is the fact that it gives people an opportunity to experience, in particular, wild places that they otherwise probably can't go to, and become informed about their importance and get a sense of the place, particularly as it relates to wilderness, watersheds. Why don't you talk about some of the places you've been and about how this has helped people learn about those places and help preserve them?
Well, our work is always a work in progress, and there are things that we've done that are pretty well fully produced. We've done for 4 years we've worked on a project called Interactive Watersheds. And there are five watersheds across the United States that are fairly major watersheds where we've developed a lot of panoramas and hot spots with audio video spots.
Yes.
Looking at the resources of these watershed areas. And those are pretty well produced, and they'll be ongoing possibly for years as they continue to do work in the watersheds. Things that are not quite fully produced, for example, your next person that you're going to interview,
Mike Mass.
Mm-hmm. I just got an email from him yesterday that encouraging people to go to the hearings on the Boulder White Clouds, and that's the current big issue, and they're trying to determine the boundaries of which will be the wilderness in the Boulder White Cloud areas in Idaho. And we've got a site with a lot of panoramas on that, about that area, and we've been trying to work with the different environmental groups and the wilderness groups to get them to link to these sites and try to develop a better, more descriptive and more visualized understanding of what these areas are like, so that people have a better chance of understanding them and then being positive about wilderness preservation and bigger boundaries. And that, we sometimes we're successful at that to a certain extent, and sometimes we're not. But it's, a, as I said, a work in process to try to get what we do and what other people are doing to be coordinated together in a way that makes the best effort possible to educate people and help them understand how valuable these wilderness and other resources that we have around us, how valuable they are, and how we need to all be involved in helping protect them for the future.
Gary, I'm going to say this unequivocally, if that's pronounced right, I think it is, that I believe that what you offer is one of the most valuable tools to anybody who has a concern for preserving wild places. This is a powerful tool to educate the public and let them literally experience, they get to explore, plus there's in many cases sound effects and many special features that unfortunately we're not going to have time to really cover today on the Wild Side News. But go, now let's let people know how they can find your website, and then everybody go there and enjoy and have fun. Talk to, give us your website again.
Okay, it's I think just the words Mountain Visions with an S on the end .com will get you to our website with lots and lots of links to all kinds of projects that we've been involved in.
And your phone number?
We're in Idaho at 208-336-2992.
Gary, Katie, thanks for being on the Wild Side News. I hope a lot of people learn about what you're doing.
The wondrous panoramic vistas that Mountain Visions provide are a perfect introduction to our next segment as we get the big picture of the state of our oceans from the director of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, Dr. Charles Kenner, when your voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Over the past 20 years, the world's oceans have undergone tremendous changes. These have already been felt in economic disruptions to fishing industries, changes in weather as the oceans warm, impacts on whole wildlife communities. What is the underlying truth of the future of our oceans, and ultimately to ourselves? When we return, our special State of the Oceans report from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography continues here on the Wild Side News. And now, Dr. Charles Kennell, director of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, gives you this State of the Oceans report. We're talking today with Dr. Charles Kennell, who is the director of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Where do you see Scripps in terms of its importance in studying the ocean these days?
Well, Scripps was the first institution to undertake interdisciplinary study of the ocean. That meant the biology, the physics, the chemistry, the geology of the oceans. And it was our second director, Thomas Wayland Vaughan, that changed our name to the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, meaning interdisciplinary studies. He did that in 1925, and so we've been interdisciplinary now for almost 80 years. And it's given us a very unique view of how all the ocean systems are interconnected. They are part of the whole picture behind the ocean.
It's taken billions and billions of years to create this miraculous diversity. The Pew Report really suggested that there have been some dramatic changes, particularly in the last 20 years.
Yeah, actually, in almost quite a number of areas, human beings have changed the face of the Earth very dramatically in the last 20 to 50 years. But in the areas of the ocean, one of the most striking facts is that if you looked at the 17 major big fish species, their numbers have been depleted by 90% in the last 20 years. the global fish catch has been in decline around the world since 1988 for the past 16 years. And so it's quite clear that we're in the era that's facing the end of the time when we'll be eating wild fish. We're facing a time when we have to take responsibility for the marine ecosystems on our coasts. It is the coastlines around the world that are the most productive and fertile. They're the zones where the fish are growing, and they're the zones where people are catching the fish. And so what we need to do now is go to a much more advanced concept called ecosystem-based management, in which we try to preserve the conditions for abundant life, as well as the specific fish that we'd like to have. You have to get people responsible for the various parts of the human influence on the ecosystem to sit down and govern and manage the ecosystems together. I think the first issue is to arrive at a global comprehension of the seriousness of the issue, is to derive a common perception of why our global marine ecosystems have been in decline, and they are in decline around the world.
What are the main causes of that?
Every ecosystem is special. Every region has its own characteristics, its own habitat, its own structure. One of the bigger causes in the United States is what we call non-point source pollution. And you'd think, well, gee, this isn't a big effect, but every 8 months, just the oil that we deposit into the ocean from all our automobile exhausts and the oils and so forth, that amounts to an Exxon Valdez oil spill every 8 months, just from distributed petroleum pollution. You know, it's awfully hard for an individual to make an impact and to ask to do him or herself the right thing on that particular problem. But what is easy and what is important is for every individual to learn about the problems of the ocean, understand them, and then understand that there are solutions. Some of them require governmental action. Some of them require industry to change some of the ways they're doing things. Some of them require new technologies that they could say we need. And so if people come to understand the problems of the ocean, this will create a public pressure that will, in fact, lead to the changes we need.
Now, there were other problems as well.
If you think about the millions of fish in the ocean, they all live in an ecosystem. And it's all a wonderful food chain. And you would think that if you just took the one fish that you liked out of that, say the tuna, that wouldn't make too much difference. But what you've done is that this food chain is sort of like a wall that's constructed of a number of bricks. And you've taken a key brick out of the wall when you remove one of the participants in the marine ecosystem. And then something happens, a pollution event, maybe even a big El Nino, and that whole ecosystem suddenly collapses. It was a study by one of our scientists, Jeremy Jackson, that established that overfishing was the first and the primary cause of the collapse of marine ecosystems in many different habitats around the world. We're facing the time in which wild-caught fish will first become much more expensive, and then at some point they will become unavailable. And we don't want to give up fish. They're very good for the human diet. And so when we come to that phase, we're going to have two choices. Manage the marine ecosystems in our coastal waters and produce marine protected areas in which wild fish do grow and allow some of them later to be caught. And the other option will be to farm fish, aquaculture. And we need to be very careful about aquaculture's impact on the environment. For example, here the farmed shrimp and farmed shellfish, it's good for the environment. They're filter feeders. They clean the water. But on the other hand, you think about farmed salmon. The salmon are big fish. So what do we do at present? We put millions of them in a pen, we stimulate the growth of a large population of salmon, and then we take our fishing boats and we go out into the open ocean and we sweep up all the other fish and feed them to the salmon, the littler fish. So if you think by eating farmed salmon you're taking the pressure off the wild ecosystem, wrong. You've taken more out of it. And so a possible solution to that, of course, is to develop plant meal for the salmon and to increasingly feed them with plants, if that will work.
You also mentioned something that I found interesting. You said very few of the oceanic species really become extinct.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons for great hope. On land, a lot of our species have disappeared because we've destroyed the habitat. In the ocean, we could decimate the population, as we've done, but some of the fish can swim away. They can go someplace else and hide. So despite the very large loss in fish and marine animal numbers, we haven't lost as many species. They're still there. So we've got a chance to bring them back. Now, the question is, you know, how do you bring them back? And everybody says, oh, that's a really complicated problem. It's really not. What you need to do is look at the places that are important for those fish to breed. Remember, they swim around. They leave those places, too. And stop fishing. Have a marine protected area. So you have a piece of the ocean, maybe 10% of our coastal environment, maybe 20, in which we don't kill the fish.
Another serious problem are some of the fishing tactics that are used these days, particularly bottom dredging.
Yeah, people are very upset about that. And in fact, there's a complaint about it, I think, in the year 1300 to the King of England at that time, that people were dredging the bottom and tearing up the homes of the fish. And after you've done that, the fish weren't coming back. And of course, what people do is they dredge the bottom, destroy, you know, just mess up the habitats. The fish flee in fright. They're milling around in the turbulence above the dredge, and then they come along with the net and catch everything. And, of course, they don't eat everything. They just take the ones they want and throw the rest back. But in the meantime, you've gotten all the fish, and you've destroyed where they live. And it'll take a while for that habitat to reconstitute itself. And even then, there's no guarantee that the fish will come back. So it's a destructive practice.
A topic that a lot of people are talking about is the warming of the oceans.
As you know, for about 30 or 40 years, we know that greenhouse gases have been accumulating in the atmosphere. That was a Scripps research result. We also know that there's been a significant warming of the atmosphere and the land on average around the Earth, especially in the last 20 years. And very recently, we discovered through tremendous effort to look at data taken from ships all over the world over the last 50 years, we found finally that the top levels of the ocean have warmed up in an amount consistent with the atmosphere's warming. It looks like a tiny amount, a fraction of a degree in the case of the ocean. The kelps and the corals in particular are going to care if there's as much as 1 degree change in ocean temperature. There's a network of interrelated events that will occur as climate changes, and we do not know how it will all play out. We're going to see all sorts of complex changes in ecosystems that we can't anticipate, and it's going to have economic consequences. Two things have happened that have people worried. First of all, the permafrost in the Arctic is melting. That was the solid foundation on which the Arctic buildings were built, and their foundations are melting away. And then the other thing that happens with the longer summer, many biological species actually have keyed their reproductive cycle to the beginning of the spring runoff. And if that comes at a different time, it comes out of phase with the genetically timed cycle built into their bodies, we don't know what's going to happen. Our management of all ecosystems, and especially in the oceans, needs to be so much more comprehensive and understanding than it has been.
Let's go out 10 years and 20 years, and what do we really have to address in this time frame?
Yeah. As scientists, our job is to make sure that the people making decisions 40, 50 years from now have the scientific tools for them to make the right decisions. Right now, 48 nations of the world are meeting together in a continuous set of meetings to try to design a global Earth-observing system of systems. We're going to know how people, when they do something, there's a new economic development, we're going to be able to see how it's interacting with the environment. We're going to be able to see how well we're doing in managing the impact. And it's this continuous awareness of the Earth system, the contemporary Earth system, that I think the ocean and Earth science community can create in the next 20 years by building this Earth-observing system of systems. And we at Scripps want to be in the forefront of that. We're betting the farm on that opportunity.
One of the things that Scripps is known for are your collections.
Those collections are a demonstration of what is the most extraordinary fact about the ocean, that it is the biggest reservoir of life on the planet. More types of living creatures that evolution invented are in the ocean than on the land. It's a precious resource.
As we look out, the truth is we're facing some very serious decisions.
That is absolutely correct. One of the most serious opportunities that we have to work on the problem is energy conservation. It is becoming more efficient there. They're very competent people, but it is to develop an ethic that says that every time you make a new device, you ask, will it save, will it use energy more efficiently than before? We don't want to give up our life style. We don't want to give up the great civilization that we've created. And so I believe, and a lot of people believe, that it is this century that will tell the tale. It is the 21st century that either we get through it and emerge with a sustainable balance between human activity and the planetary environment, or we don't.
Now let's bring it down to people. What in the world can they do to become part of this process?
I think between the scientific community, the aquarium, communicators, perhaps this new Earth observing system will be able to put part of this continuous picture of this continuous diagnosis of the ocean onto the internet. I think actually the internet may be a tool for creating the globally connected behavior that we will need in order to arrive at a management of a global problem.
Well, I'm going to give you the opportunity to talk to the whole world and tell them your thoughts about what is most critical in the years ahead.
The solving the global environmental issues that we see gradually accumulating will require a degree of human cooperation and interconnectedness that has not yet been seen.
We're working on it.
So are we.
Dr. Charles Kennell, thank you for being here.
It's been a pleasure.
This miracle of life, it manifests in so many uncountable ways, but none is perhaps more powerfully personal than when we humans open up, truly open up, to the potentials of just what our animal friends are capable of. Our next segment touches that story head-on, as we hear about David and his personal canine companion, a dog named Hawk. It's a story you won't want to miss. So grab a Kleenex or two and set yourself down for a great and wonderful story on your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Just how far can our connection go with the animal world? We love our pets, they entertain us, they are our friends, but perhaps we have only scratched the surface of what is possible. Today, we look at canine companions, dogs who give their lives in service to us. It's a story you will always remember, and you'll hear it here when we return on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back. All of us who love nature here on the Wild Side News find our own special ways of connecting with it. Some take to the rivers, we head to the fields with our field guides and binoculars, we write, we paint. I've always loved animal communication. It's a wonderful science. It's actually the science of ethology. But today I want to explore the art of animal communication because it can reach a rather high form. The communication that exists between animal and human. And I believe we are about to take a journey that is real, rich, and wonderful. Today I have as my guest a truly amazing guy, David Ball. David, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
David, you have the opportunity to communicate with an animal that very few people will ever or could ever have. You have a friend called Hawk. Is he there with you now?
Yeah, he is. Hawk, you want to say hi? Speak to him. Hawk, speak. Speak. Say hi to everybody. Come on, say hi. Speak. There you go. Good boy.
That's great. That's Hawk, by the way. And now Hawk is with you everywhere you go, I guess. Let's get started. Tell us your story of how it is that you and Hawk have become so connected. Start at the beginning.
Well, back in 1989, I had a truck accident in which I broke my back and became a lower-level paraplegic. Got a side effect of a disease that's eaten away at my nerves, and over the years, I'm able to do less and less, so I went to an event through a rehab hospital, and I saw a person with a service dog. I got to talking to them, and they put me in contact with Canine Companions for Independence out of Oceanside, California. And I applied and went through the application process and the interviews and got accepted, and ended up with a wonderful dog named Hawk here that helps me with everything in everyday life.
Well, we're going to talk a lot more about that in the time that we have here. It took you quite a long time to be able to get to Hawk. Talk about that, about the way in which the Canine Companions, there's a terrific need and actually a bit of a shortfall. Tell us about that a little bit.
Yes. Well, I applied back in 2001. The application process took about 6 months, and then I was put on a waiting list. And I was told at the time that it could be as many as 5 years before I would get my service dog. I got lucky. For some reason, there was a cancellation. Somebody couldn't make the class, and they called me in. And Hawk happened to be there at the same time. It's a match made in heaven.
Well, I'll tell you, I was actually out at Canine Companions this last week here in outside of San Diego, and it's an amazing place. That is where you actually went through your training and met Hawk, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes. Let's talk about that training, because I tell you, people need to know about this. First of all, I'm just going to give a little background. Canine Companions raises special dogs. They actually have puppy raisers. And so all over the country, they have people who raise these dogs. This certainly is something that our listeners could participate in, and I highly encourage them to consider doing this because the need is so terrific. The puppies get special training. They have to learn 30 commands. And those that can pass that then move on to the facility. Let's talk about what happens then.
Well, at the facility that where the dogs, and I do stress that the dogs make the choice whether this is going to be the life they want or not. They get advanced training, learning how to work with wheelchairs, other medical devices, working around them, getting comfortable with them. They learn advanced commands such as turning light switches on and off, opening doors, picking items up off the floor, pulling people around in wheelchairs, a whole variety of things. The dog has to make the choice. There's a lot of people that think, you know, the dog's going to make it when they turn them in for advanced training, but if the dog doesn't want to do this, it's not going to.
You know, you mentioned that actually what happens is once you get into the training, it's a two-week intensive. And from what I understand, it's a terrifically emotional, challenging time. Let's talk about that training, because I was there during a training session, and that is precisely it. There's a lot of pressure. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of anticipation. You know, you go down there, and you almost feel like a kid on the first day of school. You're introduced to all these new people and these wonderful dogs, and almost immediately they start working you with them, trying to find a match for you, the dog that'll bond with you the best and work with you the best. And, of course, everybody picks their favorites, but, you know, you, to quote another graduate's phrase, you kind of hold your breath until they make the permanent match, which is at the end of the first week. And we, you know, we work 6 days a week for 2 weeks with these dogs, and we go on outings, you know, to public places. We work with them there at the facility. The second week they spend entirely with us, 24 hours a day, you know, part of the bonding process. And, you know, everybody picks their favorite dog, but the dog also has to pick the owner. And the trainers do a great job of matching them up. I mean, everybody that graduated in my class has got the perfect dog for them.
Well, you talked about the fact that you had a bit of anxiety and hope that Hawk and you, somehow it seems as if you connected from day one. It's almost like a romance. So there's a connection, a special magic. And I guess that day actually did come, and talk to us about that, when finally you and Hawk were officially partnered.
Oh, that was the highest point in my entire life. I've never felt so happy, so optimistic. I went from dealing with this disability and the things that come along with it to an optimistic view of what my future was going to be, what Hawk was, you know, going to do for me, the doors he was opening for me. It's indescribable. I mean, how well he makes you feel about yourself. All the dogs, everybody that got matched up, you know, it was, their matches made in heaven. They are like a romance.
You know, you talked about the fact that before Hawk, your life was much more isolated, and society reacted to you in actually sort of distasteful ways. Talk about what happened since Hawk has come into your life.
Yes, you know, beforehand, people, they tended, in my experience, and I'm not saying this is for everybody, but in my experience, people tended to shy away. They didn't want to talk with me. You know, I was on my own, so to speak. But ever since I've had Hawk, you know, people, they want to come up and talk. They want to find out about Hawk and what he does for me. They want to spend time. They want to see some of the stuff he can do. It's a whole new lifestyle. You know, it just pulls a person out of their shell real quick.
I found that to be the story amongst different people who have their dogs, that it's a totally life-changing experience. We have about 2 minutes left, David, and I'd love to hear some of the highlights of this, of what has happened. You only had your dog since, I think, February this year. Is that correct?
Right.
Yeah. Talk to me about some of the miraculous things that have developed between you and Hawk.
Hawk's been there for me. I've had, you know, a couple bad weeks where I couldn't do anything just because of pain levels, and he would sit right there by my side. He's almost gotten to the point where he can anticipate my needs, even when I'm, you know, physically down and unable to do much. You know, if I want to go to the refrigerator to get something out for supper, he knows that that's where I'm headed, and he opens that door for me. We get out and I'm getting tired or something, he moves just a little bit closer and positions himself so I can grab his harness, you know, like he's ready for me to pull, or for him to pull me. He's bonded with me much more than I ever thought was possible.
You know, I heard, now most of the, actually, the commands are very direct, and you have to kind of guide the dog through a series of very specific commands to get them to do things. But I've also heard that they that you and Hawk have had some special moments. For example, if you'd care to share the fact that at night sometimes you've had difficulties, and there was apparently a moment where Hawk seemed to instinctively know what your needs were. Can you talk about that? We only have about 30 seconds left.
Yeah, it started back in team training, actually, the first night he was with me. He figured out that at night, when I flip and flop at night, the pain is what keeps me up. I couldn't sleep much. So from the second night on, he gets on the bed with me. He positions his body in such a way to hold me in one position all night, comfortably. It's not uncomfortable. We're both real comfortable, but I can't turn over at night, and I sleep the whole night through now.
David, thank you so much. I wish we had 2 hours. Maybe we can do that sometime. I want people to go to Canine Companions. That's at cci.org. David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming along. The Wild Side News is not just a radio show. It's a family of stories and people and information on the greatest gift we have, life on Earth. I invite you to explore the archives and tune in each Thursday from anywhere in the world, as the voice of the Earth reaches out around the globe on the Wild Side News, from Harrisburg to Hamburg, Staten Island to Strasbourg, Caribou to Copenhagen, Honolulu to Havana, Chicago, the Bronx, London, Geneva, San Diego.